Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 3rd, 2003. Today's session is entitled Motherhood and Spiritual Purpose, Session 3 of Birth of a Mother, The Spiritual Journey Through Pregnancy, Childbirth, and Motherhood, presented by Megan Cummins, number CUM 2003-03. Let's listen in.
So today I wanted to focus on how we can connect mothering to our spiritual purpose in the context of a time when this role is still so undervalued in our culture anyway. Oh, by the way, just for the record, I'm Megan Cummins. I've read so much on this stuff, and I don't know if you guys get Mothering Magazine. There was an article in there a few months ago about how women or mothers contribute to the economy or don't. Mm-hmm. And it said that in the U.S. Census, when we all get polled for the census, if you check the box for a homemaker, you're not counted.
You're not counted. As a person?
As a person.
Why?
Because
you're not bringing in income.
Right. Oh. And so this was true in Canada as well, and some moms got together and formed a coalition to change that. Which is there are really serious consequences for that, because all of government allocation for money and programs and things like that only goes to people who are, groups who are counted on the census. So if mothers aren't counted, then our resources become extremely limited. And then there's the fact that, in mostly Northern European countries, for example, mothers can take up to 3 years maternity leave. The first year they'll get 60% of their salary, and after that, 30, but they can, mothers and fathers, talking about ways moms get the short end of the stick in our culture. And mothers and fathers can choose, who takes the time off, and then they're always assured their job when they go back. And, in this country, you're lucky to get 6 weeks. And, if the employer knows you're pregnant, a lot of times they'll just sort of give you busy work to do for the next week. They don't think you're coming back, or that you won't be as productive. And I heard an anecdotal story of this woman at work who had a child and had to leave because she was sick. And the supervisor said to another man who was a father, "This is why we don't hire parents." And it's like, okay, but the fathers, these men that are working are parents, but people only say that about women.
It's because the woman is expected to be the one to leave work.
Right.
And the man isn't, in our culture.
Right. Exactly. And even in my own situation, I find myself, people say, "What do you do?" And I used to say, "I'm just a mom," And then people would sort of just change the subject or go on to somebody else or whatever. And and I remember too, in college I minored in women's studies, and at the time I wasn't ever thinking of having a family, but in hindsight I realized that, we never talked about motherhood as anything important except as something to be avoided if you wanted to make a better life. Yeah.
That's what I get so frustrated with, is like somehow motherhood is anti-feminist.
Yes.
Like, I get really frustrated with that. I mean, and I hear that all the time, especially my sister-in-law. She's like a national banker and stuff. And when I talk to her on the phone, she'll say, "So when are you going to start your life?"
Yeah.
And
right.
That's really true.
Things like that. And even just, we're so political about, reproductive rights on the preventative But once you get pregnant, we just are conditioned to sort of put everything in the hands of the medical community and just sort of let them make all these decisions. And so in childbirth, too, it's just one of those things that I discovered. There is no more feminist issue than the way we choose to give birth. I mean, people in some areas of this country still are strapped down and stuck with IVs and shaved and all this dehumanizing stuff. We've rarely realized that we, as the consumers of these services, is what they are. You know, we are the ones in charge. And I remember talking to, when I was pregnant with Eva, I was teaching in school, and there was a teacher that was teaching women's studies and social studies or something. And she was telling me all about, you know, her experiences being pregnant. And she kept saying, like, oh, there are so many women where they tell you their horror stories and tell you, you know, this. And then she ended up being one of these people. Who was just, you know, like, she asked me where I was going to give birth, and I said, well, I'm not really sure yet. And she said, you're not thinking of doing it at home, are you? And I said, well, actually, yeah, I'm considering the possibility. And she went on to tell me how she had this terrible birth, and she was so grateful that she had been in the hospital and all this stuff. And I was thinking, you know, but she hadn't really even explored how the things that she teaches, you know, apply to her life as a mom, not just as a woman. And so I'm just really interested in talking with people about how we can. I mean, I'm always talking to moms about, you know, we gotta like band together and you know, write our congresspeople and our senators and you know, be politically active as mothers, not just as women, you know, and because it's not going to change if we keep just going along with the status quo. But it's so hard to get people to see their job as mothers as you know, bigger deal than we make it, I guess. You know, it's hard to get beyond the diapers and the you know, what color is your kid's poop and how are we going to get them in preschool and all that stuff, and see ourselves as raising the next generation.
Megan, I should have asked you ahead of time, but I didn't know if I could be here. Well, I want to be sure that I don't cause the conversation to be constrained because of having a male present.
Nope, we love to have men present. They're definitely a part of this.
Well, I'm learning slowly, but.
I'm glad you're here. Thank you for coming. This book, too, I was reading it at the beginning of this week, A Share of Night, A Share of Morning. And she's a rabbi, and she writes a lot about parenting as a spiritual journey, and basically what I'm sort of getting from this and my own sort of search is that we have to find ways to sort of internally, first of all, to value our own situation, you know, and our own roles, and it then sort of extends outward from there. And she just has a whole bunch of great, just sort of stories, people's stories. I'm not really sure how to describe it, actually. but she's got a really great spiritual take on the little thing that is involved in parenting, and how she talks about, like, she tells this story, and I'll just read this part of it too, because I thought it was kind of poignant. Oh, okay. There was once a devout Christian who had trouble praying. Every time he tried to think about God, his thoughts wandered to images of beautiful women. He went to his priest for a wise priest advised him not to banish his thoughts, but rather to weave them into his prayer, to let him continue thinking about beautiful women and create a prayer around the ideal of beauty as one of God's great accomplishments. This is what we parents can do, can learn to do if we're lucky. We can let the distraction become part of the worship. And I think that's part one of the hardest parts too, especially if you've gone from, you know, put a lot of time and energy into educating yourself to have a career and, you know, be really productive in the outside world. And then the transition into being a mom at home, it's sort of like you're not doing your part, or I felt like I was playing hooky, you know, like I was, that I just should be doing something else all the time. And it wasn't until I was able to start saying to myself, you know, there is nothing else I have to be doing today except making sure the baby is fed and happy and clothed. And, you know, or John would come home and say, what did you do? And I was, but then I was like, well, you know, Eva's happy and, and, you know, dry and clean and all the stuff. And you know, making those things meaningful somehow. But I don't know, what do you guys have?
Well, I think Mary knows about this. I mean, we've had a lot of struggles in our house with how we divide things.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I started thinking, okay, actually, my full-time job is parenting. It's not housekeeping.
Mm-hmm.
That things became a lot more clear.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think that whole thing we were sort of talking about yesterday, where especially when they're new, but forever, you can't get anything done. And so when there's nothing ever tangible or anything you can ever show, really, for what you've been doing all day, which may have been, you know, basically arguing with your child, or, you know, a tantrum can take 2 hours out of your day, depending on the child. And so same thing, when Ben would come home and say, so what'd you do today? Or when we wake up in the morning, he said, so what are your plans today? And I'm like, I just think, like, that whole thing, like, when whatever, as a homemaker or whatever,
mm-hmm.
when the cleaning becomes what you're focused on because it's tangible and your spouse or the world can see, oh, she actually has been doing something today. I mean, I think that's a really hard thing. I think that's an interesting idea, that really parenting is my job.
Mm-hmm.
And I think especially when it's, when babies are new, and you don't, like, now I can kind of look back, now that Forrest is almost six, and say, oh yeah, he's doing really well.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I'm gonna take a little credit for this, since
mm-hmm.
I also take a lot of blame for this.
Right.
You know, all these, and this, like, Ben spends hours reading as part of his job, but I always felt guilty about reading parenting books because I enjoyed it. It was so relevant to my life. I thought, oh, I should be doing dishes, you know.
Right.
And then when I finally was like, no, this is my job.
Right.
It's educating myself on this.
Right.
It's just a really different way of thinking about things, though.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I remember feeling guilty for hanging out with other friends
mm-hmm.
with kids all day, talking and playing, and then getting home at 5 o'clock and dinner still wasn't ready and things. And finally I started looking at it like, okay, this is my career, and these other moms are my coworkers, and
mm-hmm.
we're totally, you know, discussing management policies and all of this stuff,
and our kids are learning.
And your kids, yeah. And so, but it is, I mean, it is hard to, you know, John is a very intellectual person. He's deeply concerned with the, you know, big issue, the big questions in life, and he reads really heavy stuff, and he's always encouraging me to read that stuff too, so we can have something to talk about. And I'm saying, well, why don't you pick up one of these parenting books, or, you know, or if I make a decision in regards to the kids, and he asked me to trust you about certain things. This is the research that I'm doing, and I'd like you to just, you know, that's sort of the form that it takes to get within your household, I guess. But, I have this other book called In Her Image, and it's mostly about relationships between mothers and daughters and what the challenges are and the injuries that occur and ways to get on. She writes a lot about feminine psychology and religion of the goddess. And there's a chapter in here about the great mother. She just talks about there was a time when to be a woman was to be directly in the image of the divine, when God was a woman, and her spaciousness filled the vision and touched the hearts of every man, woman, and child. And she talks about the activity of true naming of ourselves as the biggest task of sort of the individuation of women today. And it just, again, when I was younger and, studying feminism and stuff, it just never includes motherhood. I don't know, I totally had this experience of feeling like giving birth to a child and the love that you feel for a child is like the closest thing to understanding what it's like to be God. I mean, you made life, you brought it forth, and there's nothing on this planet that child can do to make you love it less. And that was what made me first understand how God loves us. And that just gave a whole new perspective to my job, she talks about that. She's talking about labels and the label often sort of makes people think of that's all there is to a woman, that she doesn't have greater yearnings and higher aspirations or other goals or ambitions in her life. And and she's saying that even if people believe these labels, they may continue to feel that something precious is being misperceived, that something significant and real in their experience is not being seen. This is true in so many areas of women's lives. It is part of the reason we need to create a new language, as Adrienne Rich suggests, to name our experience authentically and why we need increasingly to risk more in revealing ourselves to each other. And and it talks about how there's little in our culture to guide us, through this initiation of the transition from being one kind of woman to another. One thing that came to mind for me is how important it is to be in community, with other mothers and to talk about these things, and that's how we come up with new language. And we've all been talking with each other quite a bit about parenting and what is so much, so affirming to me for what I'm doing, that I feel like I can go back to the actual work of parenting my children and feel like I'm doing something important, you know? This part that I thought was a good part, and then point two, that we come up with some radical ideas about feminine creativity and see a new angle on the answer to that tired old question, why aren't there more creative women? Looking at blood power symbolically, we could say there is a power in what flows from within us. What flows out of us periodically as an expression of feminine nature is the power to fructify, to facilitate life around us, or to freeze it. This reflects nature herself, which both engenders and supports life and destroys it. Looking at psychologically and symbolically, our flow, our magic flow could be a flow of words, of feeling, passion, judgment, and sexuality. But in our culture, only one kind of consequence is supposed to come about from our flow. In our culture, there's great emphasis on women being facilitators. We are taught that our flow should be used to support and fertilize life only. And we are punished and feared if our power is used to limit or prevent others. And then she talks about the ancient myths that also suggests that if we choose to withhold our flow, to retain it and store it up, we have the power to create new life by ourselves. And this is a profound image, this willful introversion and creation not dependent on connection with a man. That is suggesting that, you know, withholding or refusing, keeping our magic for ourselves is one source of feminine creativity. And this is sort of taboo in our culture. We're supposed to flow out, nourish and support others, be a service, especially to children and men, which is, others depend on that flow as if it were lifeblood, and yet it is also devalued. A woman who spends her life serving a man, a household, and children is seen as just a housewife. Many women feel a taboo around keeping some of their flow for themselves or refusing to flow, claiming the right to say no. This taboo is what underlies the huge concerns expressed about being selfish. Do I have the right? Do I have a right to have something for myself separate from the family? Do I have a right to have for myself if it means depriving someone else? The right to space and time for herself, to nourish herself instead of always nourishing others, to use her skills and gifts and passion for herself has been taboo for some women. Even having their own thoughts and images are seen as somehow illicit and dangerous. But she goes on to talk about how, you know, the flow happens in cycles. You know, we give out, we withhold. That's the natural way of things. And to sort of incorporate that balance. She talks about how retaining the flow to create new life also happens only periodically, though it lasts for 9 months in pregnancy. Interestingly, this is often the time it takes women to complete projects. storing up and introversion are not ultimate endpoints, but only one part of the cycle. So that's another piece that, you know, we were talking about this yesterday, that sometimes when, you know, like when I've been being with my daughter all the time, I get pretty worn out, and you know, we tell them that I get irritated with me, but then I get called over for like 18 hours and I'd be gone all day and really helping someone else and being part of, you know, a greater picture of them. And I'd be so happy to come home to my kids and get so much more out of them. And so another piece that helps add meaning to your work is when you have some distance from it. And But there's, I don't know if you guys feel this, but I it's so hard to make time to do that. And we were talking about that last yesterday, like, sometimes, no matter how much time you have to yourself, it doesn't do anything for you. But, I don't know, what are some of your thoughts on this stuff?
I have two grandchildren, mm-hmm. and I am astounded at my daughter's ability to keep going. She had two children close together because they thought they couldn't get pregnant. They couldn't get pregnant in the beginning, and so they thought they'd have to go through the same 3-year stuff with drugs to get pregnant again, and so they didn't use any caution about whether they conceived, and they didn't. So they have two close in age, and when I go there, I come home from spending 36 hours there, and I'm wiped out.
Right.
And all I have done is tend to one of the two children, and the one is in arms, and the other is a rascal at age 2. But I don't know where she gets the energy. It just boggles my mind that she can do this 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
Except that she does have a husband who's a lot smarter than I was,
mm-hmm.
and he really sees his role as being a partner in the parenting, which in my generation was just beginning. And there's something in the male mentality, in my opinion, and I don't know how to explain it, and I can't advise any of you how to talk to your spouses, because my experience as a male may have been dramatically different from what it is for some other men.
Mm-hmm.
But when we had our 4 children, I was oblivious.
Mm-hmm.
I was so caught up in my work that, and all the time, I thought that I was being very generous with my time at home. And my motives and intentions were good, but my drive to be a better pastor meant I neglected my children and my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see that now with clarity.
Mm-hmm.
But even though I got warnings from other older pastors who said, spend more time with your children and be sure you take care of your wife, with hindsight, I didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, is there any way that you can occasionally find a time when you can talk to a spouse or a partner about about some of the needs that come with this doubt waterfall of energy drain. Your kids are about the ages of ours,
mm-hmm.
two and less than one.
Mm-hmm.
And her husband is thoughtful and gives her occasional times, and when we come individually to try to help with the kids. She'll to get chores done.
Mm-hmm.
They'll go off for 2 hours. But I've struggled with how, you see, I, as an old person, I can look at that and see what I did wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how in your situations, if you've got a friend or spouse close by, how you communicate in a way that they can actually hear it.
Mm-hmm.
What it means to be bound to those children.
Maybe you should start having sessions on them.
Yeah, I think you should.
Because I'm not quite sure what the secret is. This won't help you, but what happened in our situation, and I feel just terrible about it because I was mainly for not giving her the chance to escape after 3 years of this. we got in a big argument about, she told me I was not meeting her needs, and I'm a very defensive person by nature and by earlier environment. And I said, well, you have some needs that I can't meet. No, you have some needs. You have some needs that I can't meet. Did I say that right? Oh, okay. Anyway, she buttoned her lip. We've been chatting with each other late at night. And I knew I was in big trouble. Because she knew it was true, and I knew it was true, but I also knew it was a stupid thing to say. So she stomped off down to the bedroom and whoop, whiny, slammed the door shut. And the next morning, she announced to me that she was going away for a day every week, and that I could find a child care provider, or I could stay home with the kids and take care of them myself, but that she wouldn't be there. And that's what, then that went on for 8 years, routinely a day or 2 days, even when she was attending the seminary. But it was a survival plan for her at first, and then it became a call. But if it hadn't been for that, for me having driven her into a corner where she had to do something because I was not hearing her. I was not able to be sympathetic enough, even though I had this notion about myself that I was. But I'm thinking there got to be other ways to get over that hurdle where you can claim your ownership and right to have time for yourself. That is apart from the children, no matter how you find it. I remember that I went to West Berlin, where I was in a German congregation, and the pastor and his wife had 12 kids. Two were grown, but the youngest was 4.
And how many years of pregnancy is that?
Too many.
And these are people who never complained.
Right.
These are not complainers. And the kids were wonderful too. But I was quite startled when they both told me, I would eat lunch with them each day. And they both told me about their plan. They called it a survival plan, which was every 3 months they would take turns. One of them would go away for 2 days to a convent that provided a retreat center, and just go there early on one morning and come back late to the second night later. And each one of them did it, her husband and she, and each one did it every 6 months, but they would rotate. And I think that was their way of trying to communicate to each other that each of them needed space away from the family, away from the kids at least, and maybe even away from each other, just to get their heads screwed on straight again. But there's got to be a way to get to that without a clash. My daughter, I mean, it's a 24-hour day job, and if I were here, I'll accuse her of being still tied to her umbilical cord, because they have a walkie-talkie between the room where the baby sleeps and the kitchen, so that as soon as the baby wakes up and starts making noises, my daughter hears the baby and gets ready, you know, to go up. But still, you know, that's her. How she does it is her business and not mine. But I'm, you know, when I look at the 4 of you here, I don't know if all of you have children. I know you do, and I know you do. But I, you know, I just feel worn out thinking about what it means to have those kids running around, and that you're primarily left with the responsibility. And if you're like, if your husbands are like me, they don't quite get it. They get a lot of it, and I think, you know, I think of someone like Ben, he probably gets a lot more of it, I'm sure, than I ever did. But there's something going on there in male and female thinking and psychology and shape, address toward life that's a little different. Mm-hmm. And I think it makes communicating your needs as parents who are under constant pressure. Mm-hmm. And then to try to help a spouse get on board with that, mm-hmm. To realize that it is not a job.
Right.
It's a high demand, 24-hour-a-day on-call,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
Position that you cannot escape unless you exit.
Mm-hmm. Stella's sister-in-law had a way of doing it. Have you heard this?
No.
Stella's sister withholds sex unless the dishes are done.
Mm-hmm. It's powerful.
It is powerful. I said I didn't think I'd go that far.
Yeah.
She just says, I won't have energy.
Get help? Yeah. I don't know if it's possible to do it without a clash. And I think...
Constant clash.
Right.
no way.
Sometimes, at least in our marriage, those clashes are big signals for major... We've come to not fear and dread them. You know, we really, really capitalize on their... the strength of emotion and presence of mind to create some change, and in hopefully in a loving way. But we're getting better at that, but sometimes it's pretty mean. But it definitely gets the job done. I mean, but I remember John saying to me when we were talking about having another child, I really wanted even to have a sister. And I was having issues with, I was still so half in and half out of that world, you know. Just one kid, I could pretty much take her anywhere. She's very adaptable. I could still do a lot of the things that I like to do. But it's caused me great anxiety because I was so divided. And I thought, you know, if I have another child, I'm just her child, I'm going to be totally in it. It's just, I'm a mom and that's it. And I can focus my attention. And thankfully, that was the effect that it had. and I'm not, I'm sunk in it and I'm glad to be fully there. John really didn't want another child. To him, it sucked more, you know, life out of him than anything, and he wasn't doing work that he really enjoyed, so when he was home, he really wanted time for himself to paint or read or whatever, and I kept thinking, I asked him once, do you think that there's nothing else that I would like to be doing with my time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But these babies are young, and this, you know, the investment is now. And he said, well, fatherhood is not my life's work. And I just, how much time you put into it, you are a dad, and your role is just as central as mine, and I don't expect you to be what I am to these kids, or, you know, and obviously part of your role as father and husband is to work and bring home dinner while I'm home with these kids. But my job is to be a mom, and I'm willing to accept, you know, most of the responsibility for that. And anyway, we came to the conclusion that, it was a good time to do it. It's a good time as any. But that he was going to go to grad school and pursue a resume. And that was sort of the bargain. I get another kid, he goes to grad school. And he is so much more available when he's home because he's doing the browser. And, you know, some people look at what I'm doing and thinking, you're making a sacrifice in a really unhealthy way. You're sacrificing all your goals and all this because it's going to be a while. And I think, no, it's a pretty worthwhile thing to support the father of my children and what makes his life meaningful. really has been a great thing. And it's really, and so then he's, you know, he, when he is home, he says, you know, is there anything you need to be doing right now? Do you need to go see friends or, you know, whatever? And he's pretty supportive in that way. And I'm aware of how fortunate I am because I have a lot of friends whose husbands, they have first children, and they just, they still have that battle all the time. And I mean, it comes with time, I think, too. But especially as the kids get older and they're less dependent on moms for all of their physical needs, you know, they develop more of an attachment to the dad. And the dads enjoy doing things more with them. But
that has Justin, last year, like in between the time that he turned one and this 18-month period, was waking up like every hour or two to nurse. And we have housemates, so I was like, I can't let this child cry. I mean, we wake up the house, and it's just easier. But I did get to a point where I did pass out from exhaustion, and at that point, Ben, I went to the guest room. Our housemate was out for the week, and Ben started taking nights with Justin. Well, obviously, he didn't wake up anymore an hour to nurse because he knew there was no nursing, but that made a huge difference in the way I feel about things, too. I mean, I have that sacred time. And also, he says he wished he'd done it with Forrest because it's such precious time, that cuddle time. And I don't know. I can't really complain at all about the amount of time Ben spends with the kids. Incredible amounts of time. The problem is that what ended up happening was he'd come home and have all this great time with the kids, and I wouldn't have played with them all day because I was so busy keeping the house running. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, that distinction is so important. That is not my job.
Right.
To take care of everybody.
Mm-hmm. I know, I had to say to Eva, I am your mom, I'm not your playmate. You don't have a sister, you have friends. And, you know, it's just, I can't do that.
I don't love to either, but I do like to. I mean, there are some things I like to do with them, and when I don't have time, and this really hit me. Forrest was playing with Ellie, and they were playing house, and he was like, "I'm a dad, and you're the mom. My job is to play with the kids, and your job is to clean the house." And I was like, "Oh, he's really wrong here." So that's when I kind of had a fit. Yeah.
I'm kind of happy to hear you say that. Maybe those clashes are okay sometimes, that maybe that's the only way sometimes to break through. But then, of course, the question becomes whether you're hooked up with someone who you can risk that with. And that, I know, for has got to be for a lot of women iffy question. It's another good reason, I think, for having a spiritual basis for your relationship, because then you know you can risk it, depending on who your spouse is. But if that's sometimes the only way to make the change, then you have to be careful how you gauge what the conflict is going to be over and when it's going to happen. But I think, can I share an opinion? I'm sharing too many, and I don't mean to be taking so much time, but I think that you can and should use your sexuality to get your needs met. The reason is that it is, I think, it's one of the most powerful driving forces in men's lives. Mm-hmm. Whether we like it or not, it is. And if it is managed reasonably rather than in anger, like when you say, or a friend said, if the dishes don't get done, I'm going to be too exhausted to be engaged in sexual relations. That's a fair trade-off, because A male mind can hear that and say, I'm given a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds a little bit like the choices you give to children, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's not always so far off. I'm given a legitimate choice here, and I can either do something I'd rather not do and get what I want, or not get it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fairly clear message. And I think that reasonable men, at least, would say, well, you know, it's not that she doesn't love me, it's that she's got too much to do, and I need to help with that.
And it is true. I mean, if you're getting no help, and you're cleaning up after everybody, you don't have much to give. I mean, I've said that before, too. I mean, like, I just don't have any more to give tonight. And if, you know... I wanted to just say, like, getting back to sort of that, I don't know, feminist stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is something I learned in my doula class that I never heard, that I do try to tell women, young women especially, at every possible thing. But, I mean, you never hear about, like, the fact that the uterus is the strongest muscle in the body.
Right.
Like, how about that? Possible. No matter how much men lift weight, they can never have a muscle as strong as the uterus. Like, you never hear that.
No, you don't.
And, I mean, I think that's just an interesting thing, and I just think...
There's one woman in this book, when we're talking about birth, that says... You know, I really, after having this baby, I believe this is why men go to war, you know, because they can't do this, you know, and why they have to, you know, build skyscrapers and, you know, atomic bombs and things like that,
because they don't have that
power. Right, and also they have become obstetricians, but
yeah,
that's another story. in Taiwan, these forces, but,
That raises another angle. I think this has a lot to do with one's spiritual welfare.
Yes.
And that is to see if you can discover the many things about women,
mm-hmm.
especially those things that make women attractive to men,
mm-hmm.
that are great strengths
mm-hmm.
or great gifts.
Mm-hmm.
And men don't get them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to be able to highlight those from the ground up, I wish we could do it in high schools
mm-hmm.
so that young women could develop a self-esteem before mm-hmm. they're in this business of sexual back and forths. But I think that probably never goes away,
mm-hmm.
to be reminded of strengths that belong to you alone.
I mean, I think that is why this is so... I mean, I'm so interested in, like... birth, like doulas in prisons and things like that, because I just think that process, if it goes well, the self-esteem and just power that you can feel from having brought life into the world. I mean, we don't even think of it that way anymore. It's, you know, having a baby, and it's all within this, you know, advertisements of, you know. Really, the important thing about having a baby is, like, the nice nursery and the clean whatever and looking good. I mean, it's not, like, the focus of, like, oh, my God, you've grown a baby.
Right.
And then you are going, from your body, from your milk, is going to grow a child. I mean, it's going to, I mean, that is an amazing thing.
Right.
I mean, but just the whole, I don't know.
Well, it has a lot to do with the whole history of obstetric medicine and science. And, you know, the biggest thing, you know, earlier in the century, all of this technology sort of liberated women from their biology so that they could go to work,
mm-hmm.
which was a way to navigate in a patriarchal system their work. You know, they're being, you know, you have to be able to do what men can do. You can go to work, you can be a CEO, you can, you know, build automobiles together, whatever it is. And there is still this prevalence of that birth is suffering, and which it is, but that it's something you shouldn't have to deal with. You know, you shouldn't have to breastfeed your baby when you can just give it a bottle, and then you're free to you know, do all this, be productive and all this stuff, or you shouldn't have to experience the pain in childhood. That's just, there's just no reason for it, you know, all this. And the thing, you know, what women discover when they choose an alternative path to pregnancy and birth is that there is a purpose for this pain. Our bodies are designed for that purpose. If you break your leg, you feel pain because there are, you know, nerve receptors that are going, something's wrong, you know, so you do something about it. That doesn't happen in childbirth. You know, your body is totally hooked up to know exactly what is going on. And yes, it's intense, and nobody's going to deny that it's painful, but there is a purpose to it, and we always talk about that pain with a purpose, and you can get through anything if there's a purpose, you know.
And I just, sorry.
Oh, no, I just was remembering I had a ruptured uterine cyst a year ago, which was, you know, I've never given birth, and it was the most painful thing I'd ever felt in my life. And when I talked to my mother about it afterwards, she had had about the same thing happen to her when she was about my age, like in her mid-20s. And she was like, Miriam, in some ways that was more painful than childbirth for me because there wasn't the purpose. There wasn't the sense that there's like this goal for, you know, it's just pain. It's just pain, and you don't understand like when it's gonna end.
Right.
Like childbirth was painful, but I got through it fine. You know,
right.
That was like I thought I was gonna die.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was just this. It's definitely that contrast.
And if you,
it can kill you.
If you don't, I mean, that's the interesting thing. I think about that. Like, if you don't have pain when you're giving birth, and you're not producing the good hormone. I mean, the good.
Yeah.
I can never think of these different ones, but like when you climb a mountain, you have the high that you get from that. You get that from giving birth, but if you don't have the pain, then your body doesn't produce those chemicals, and it's also the bonding chemicals with your baby.
It's tremendous. I mean, it's perfect. It's perfect the way it's designed to work. And you know, so if you know about this as a young woman, for example, if we had all teenage moms to breastfeed, they would bond with those babies. They would feel responsible. They would be connected, and they would think twice about doing it again anytime soon. It's so much work. I mean, but as it is, they can separate themselves so much, and they are just, especially getting pregnant so young, they're already, you know, feeling terrible, and you know that you know they've done something wrong.
Or just feeling that their bodies have been, you know, changed too soon, you know, like that they've been denied something that, you know, a life that has happened.
We were talking about that yesterday, like if only we could say to a pregnant teenager instead of, oh, your life is ruined, like, your life is changed, but congratulations, you're going to be a mother, and your life is changed, but it is going to be good too. I mean, your life is not ruined when you have a baby. I mean, that's what we say. Your life is ruined once you have a baby. So if you do it too young, you might as well forget it. Your life is gone. But if we could only, then maybe we could make better help them be better mothers.
Right.
As
and too, part of the issue is, you know, we, our generation especially, has been brought up to go to school and make something of our lives independently, and so there's this delay of motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we put that off until much later in our lives, in, you know, mid-30s, and then all of a sudden we think, okay, but I do want a child now, I'm ready. And
I know.
And they go off the pill or whatever, and have trouble getting pregnant. And there really, you know, there is, you can't just do it whenever you want. There is an ideal time to do it, and it's when we have the energy, and we might not have financial resources, or we might not have a career or a belt, but none of those things. There's the quote in this book, this one I keep telling you here, that says, in dealing with my child, my Latin and Greek, my accomplishments and my money study nothing, but as much soul as I have avails, and Emerson said that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true, none of that stuff applies to motherhood.
And we have this idea, too, that, again, a lot from companies trying to get us to buy stuff, that you have to be settled in a nice house with a nice yard with nice furniture before you're ready to have a baby. And I mean, I think also we have the attitude that needs to come right out of college. Like,
right.
The idea that you know, yeah, I've got an idea of what career I might want to have, but right now I am so happy to be doing this mothering.
Yeah.
Like, this is what I really want to be doing now. I see it as a luxury. I mean, and I also, we gave up a lot of, we made crazy lifestyle choices in order to do that. And I just, I mean, we have made sacrifices so I could do this. I mean, rather than I'm doing this, I'm sacrificing a lot, you know, in doing it. I mean, it's kind of the same thing, but I just think it's such a different, you know.
Well, and two, I think of it who work, because we were talking about this yesterday too. There's a book in the Christian Community Church that we all, Steiner Church that we go to in Chicago, that talks about homemaking and infusing it with a spiritual purpose, and that the source of this drive to escape motherhood is that not only are we, you know, regardless of how independent you are and how feminist you are and all this. You know, this is what I feel like writing a letter to my women's studies teacher. It says, most of these women are indeed going to get married and have babies eventually. It's not like we're just going to throw it all off because, you know, and we have no basis for making choices about that after having taken these classes, you know. And that if you work and have children, and just as much so if you just stay home with your kids, there's just more work to be done than any one person can possibly do. And we do put a lot of pressure on our husbands to help out because there isn't anyone else. And so we have these really incredible expectations of ourselves. We have to have a nice house, we have to have the car, you know, all this stuff. And it has to be clean and our kids have to be exemplar, you know, beings at the age of three. And we have to have our hair done and our, you know, all this stuff. And it's too much. And so we feel terrible that we can't accomplish all of this, and then we start to feel depressed and isolated and resentful. And so that's this vicious circle. And I think, you know, I've had countless working moms say, God, I can never stay at home. And I think I can never split my time between work and my children because I would just feel guilty that I was not in the other place, you know, like, okay, I'm not with my kids, or I should be at work, and, you know, so here again, it's like the fact that we have to make those choices, and a lot of times men say, well, you have the option, but in some ways, you know, it's such a different, there's always something that loses, you know, whereas, I mean, John gets to go to work and feel accomplished, and what you were talking about earlier, so, I don't know, in trying to find ways of teaching young women that motherhood is an acceptable career choice, you know, and an incredibly rewarding one. I mean, I think they get turned off by the ambivalent feelings we have at times when, you know, I would say this too, and John doesn't understand it at all, but I really love being home with my children. I love being a mom. It's made me a much better person than I ever was before. But it sucks sometimes, you know? And to say, like, I'm so exhausted, I want to lock him in a closet and, you know, leave the house. And he thinks, you know, and I was telling him, joking before, he gets all worried, like, oh, should I be the one staying home? You know, can I trust her with these children? But, you know, because there are mixed feelings with that, you know, what in life is not right?
I mean, that's my, like, I mean, people always complain about their jobs, but it's so tricky when part of your job is the person that you're complaining to, and it's complaining about these people that they really love, and anyway.
It's my opinion that everyone who likes their job 40% of the time is far ahead of the pack.
Exactly.
And, you know, many of us, myself included, are lucky enough to be in kinds of jobs, or at least on average anyway, 40% of the time is good.
Yeah. That's true.
I think that's really above average.
Yeah.
Unless what's yours.
I mean, that's part of the thing too. Ben loves his job.
Right.
He loves to work. It's not that he, like, feels driven to it, but he really loves it, so.
It is hard to pull away from it. The events of history were controlled in my coming to this world, no less than for the coming of the Savior. The time had to be right, the place just right, the circumstances ready before I could be born. God chose the parents of his son and endowed them with the personality they needed for the child that would be born. I speak to God about the man and woman that he chose to be my parents until I see what they had to be, the kind of human beings they were, if I was to become what God meant me to be. The Christ child comes, like every other child, to give the world a message. What message have I come to give? Have my children come to give? I seek guidance from the Lord to express it in a word or image. Christ comes into this world to walk a certain path, fulfill a certain destiny. He is consciously fulfilled what had been written for him. As I look back, I see and wonder what was written and has thus far been fulfilled in my own life. And for each part of that script, however small, I say thanks to make it holy with my gratitude. I look with expectation and surrender at all that is to come, and like Christ, I say, yes, let it be done. Finally, I recall the song the angels sang when Christ was born. They sang of the peace and joy that give God glory. Have I ever heard the song the angels sang when I was born? I see with joy what has been done through me to make the world a better place, and I join those angels in the song they sang to celebrate my birth.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding. Like, is it as positive reinforcement?
And don't tell him to do it for me. I'll get my head cut off.
I am.
But it's true.
I can't
true,
imagine
anyway.
Actually doing it.
What?
It's true.
It's hard to imagine, actually.
Like, you guys laugh saying
that.
John would go, what else is new?
I know. Oh. That's the other thing. I was
kidding. I never.
Part of it is whether it's reasonable.